welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. There is horror in this hour. Later on, the talented Nelson Olmsted tells us two stories on the Sleep No More series, but right now an episode of The Hermit's Cave. This released in 1944, the story called The Author of Murder.
The Mummers in the Little Theater of the Air.
Sit down. Let me look at you. Ah, it's good to see you again.
It's good to see you again, too.
Only seen you once since your marriage. Where do you and Lyman hide out? And how is that author husband of yours, anyway?
Well, it's your fault you haven't seen us. Been invited three times, you know.
And couldn't get away. Besides, why do you live way out in the wilderness? Hazel, you're not ill. Or are you?
No, Dr. Russell. It isn't I.
Bob. Not Dr. Russell to you, my dear.
It's easier to call you Dr. Russell on a call like this.
What can I do for you, Hazel? Here, want a smoke? Have a cigarette.
Thanks.
There now.
I came to talk to you about Lyman.
Yes? Is he ill, Hazel?
It's worse than that. I don't know what it is, but it's something dreadful. Terrible, I know.
You tell me the best you can.
Well, at first, when we moved out in the country, he seemed so happy. He was busy writing a new novel.
And he had you there with him?
Yes. I thought that should make him happy. He'd made me rush the marriage so.
Married 2 months before you planned to be, weren't you?
Yes. But then, several months after we'd been out in the country, Lyman began to act very strange. Very strange.
What do you mean?
Well, at first I thought it was fear of something. I don't know what. And then he began to sit in the library all night long.
Writing, you mean?
Some, perhaps. But when he'd come upstairs early in the morning, he'd look like someone who had undergone a terrible struggle, an ordeal. His face would be white and chalky. His eyes would jerk and his lips tremble.
How long has this been going on?
For a month now. Oh, it's terrible. Something's driving him mad. Whatever it is, it'll kill him.
Hazel, I don't know what to say. I can't say anything right offhand. But you know, my dear, writers... Well, anyway, Lyman has always been rather a peculiar chap. Normal, of course. Normal as any of us.
He's not normal now. He's changed. He's not the same. Oh, you've got to do something.
Can you get him to come and see me?
No. That's the trouble. I can't. He won't leave the house for a day. I've begged him to get out, but he won't.
Tell him you were coming to see me?
Oh, mercy, no. Just in town, shopping.
And you want me to come to him? Is that it?
Exactly.
Without his knowing, I'm making a professional call.
Yes. I want you to come for the weekend, and while there, see if you can do anything for him.
I'm not a psychiatrist, honey. I may advise pills when he needs a change of air.
Oh, I know you. You'll do the right thing. When can you come?
Well, want me this weekend? Tomorrow?
Indeed, I do.
I think I can get away this weekend. I will. I'll be there.
Oh, fine. I feel better already. About Lyman, I mean. I know you can help him if anyone can.
Don't put too much faith in a doddering old surgeon, my dear.
Oh, you're the best physician in the world, because I have faith in you. I'll be expecting you for dinner tomorrow.
Hazel, this has been a splendid dinner.
Really eaten more than I ought.
Oh, it's nice to see a man relish a meal. Lyman rarely eats.
I was going to tell you, Bob, that I have no appetite. But it isn't true.
Lyman, you know it is. Why, night after night, he leaves the table scarcely touching his plate.
It isn't true, I tell you.
Well, perhaps Lyman is more sensible than I am. Now, I know too hearty a meal isn't good for me, particularly at night. I don't recommend it to my patients, but like all who preach, I don't practice my own teachings.
Like the shoemaker's children who go without shoes?
Something like that.
Well, if you finished your coffee, shall we go to the drawing room?
Fine. Now, Lyman, how about telling me about your new novel? What's the theme?
I haven't been writing lately.
But he has to soon. He's promised his publishers it'd be ready in a month.
Don't remind me what I have to do. I'll have it ready.
I'm sure you will. With Hazel here for inspiration, it ought to go fast.
Shall we go to the drawing room, then?
Yes. This way, Bob.
Oh, beautiful here. Beautiful, really. Hazel, this is a lovely home you have out here in the country.
I'm glad you like it.
Quiet and peaceful, too. Ought to be a writer's paradise.
Oh, here, Bob. Sit in this chair. I'm sure you'll find it comfortable.
Thank you.
Where are you going to sit, Lyman?
If you'll excuse me, I think I'll go to the library. I have some work to do.
Don't let me annoy you, Lyman, or keep you from work.
But I thought you'd like to visit with Bob.
I tell you, I have work to do.
All right, of course we'll excuse you.
Yes, I have work to do.
Will you join us later?
Perhaps. No, don't wait for me. It's getting late. I'm sure Bob will want to retire soon.
Oh, but it's early yet, Lyman.
All the same, don't wait for me.
Well, what do you think?
I don't know what to think.
He does act strange, doesn't he?
Yes.
He isn't the same.
No, he isn't.
Changed. And I'm so awfully worried. Notice how he glances everywhere and looks nowhere?
I did.
What can be the trouble?
He seems to be listening for something. Waiting for something.
Yes, that's it.
Of course, Lyman's never been very loquacious.
No, that's right. He dislikes small talk.
There's something almost rude about his taciturnity this evening.
Oh, I know. Oh, Bob, as a doctor, not as a friend, what would you say is the matter?
My dear, I can't answer you yet.
Is it I? Is he tired of me?
No, I don't think so.
But I must know. Notice how white and drawn his face is.
He's under some strain, all right.
What do you propose to do?
As soon as you go upstairs to bed, I'm going to the library and sit with him.
Oh, but he won't let you.
I'm accustomed to giving orders, not taking them.
I know, but you don't know how...
He'll let me stay. Did you notice how he kept looking towards the library and yet tried to hide it from us?
Why, yes. Now that you mention it, I do.
I have a feeling that whatever it is that's bothering Lyman, the library has something to do with it. I'll do my best tonight to find out what it is. It's I, Bob.
What do you want?
Let me in, won't you?
Sorry, I'm busy.
Why lock the door, Lyman?
Never mind. Go away.
Lyman, I'll call one of the servants to open it for me. I'll rouse the whole house.
You can't come in. All right.
Well?
Come on, let a fellow in.
Came here to snoop, I know it. Hazel brought you here to watch me.
And you admit that there is something wrong, Lyman.
I admit nothing. What time is it?
Chimes just struck as I came down the hall. Let's see. 11:45.
Then you must go. Get out of here.
I don't understand.
The door. I must lock the door.
Come on, Lyman. Tell me what it is that's bothering you.
Go. Leave me alone.
No, I'm here to stay.
I have a gun here, Dr. Russell.
But you won't use it. Not on me.
She'll be coming in a moment. She'll try to get out of this room, rattle the doorknob. Try to get out of this library to kill my wife.
I confess I don't know what you're talking about. Who will come, Lyman?
You'll hear her in a minute. Moving out of those bookshelves. Moving towards me. Towards the door.
Who do you mean?
At first, you'll smell the perfume she always wore.
Lyman, who are you talking about?
Shirley Gray. The ghost of Shirley Gray.
Shirley Gray?
Ghost of Shirley Gray. She lives in this room. And at night, midnight, she tries to get out and kill Hazel.
Oh, now come, Lyman. You've been working too hard. Your mind is weary. Your imagination is working overtime. Better go up and get some sleep.
I knew this would be the way. I knew what you'd say. You think I'm out of my mind? You think I'm crazy? Well, I'm not. You doctors are fools. can't see. Only measles, smallpox. You only can see something that bats you in the face.
It's only because I can see that I'm asking you to go upstairs and get some rest. No one can go on sleepless for weeks and remain sane.
I'm sane, all right. More than you are. Listen, the clock. It's midnight. She'll be here in a moment. Listen. Listen, do you hear? Listen, if you dare. Do you hear her?
I hear nothing, Lyman.
She's coming nearer. I can almost see her tonight. She's dressed in a soft, flowing gown. She's coming closer towards me. Nearer. Nearer. She's coming nearer. Shirley, I didn't kill you. I didn't mean to kill you.
Lyman, what on earth is the matter?
Dr. Russell, don't grab my arm. Let me go. Let me go, I tell you. Let me go. Can't you see? She's moving towards the door. She wants to get out. No! No, you can't get out of here. I'll stop you. No! No, you can't get out that door. Get back. Back into the shelves. I didn't mean to kill you, Shirley. Get back into the shelves. Back, back. I'm pushing her back. I'm winning. Winning. Back. Back into the shelves. Back. There.
Lyman. Lyman, what is it?
It's all over now. I won. She didn't get out. She's gone back. Now I can go upstairs and sleep. Sleep. I've won the battle for another night. Now I can...
Who is Shirley who comes out of the bookcase at midnight? Is it someone Lyman killed? The hermit will tell you before the night is done.
There are people in most countries who would like to live in the Republic of the United States or the Dominion of Canada, where that good Olga Cole is sold. The citizens of our free countries are the envy of many people elsewhere because of the personal freedom which we have enjoyed. Why, then, doesn't every country adopt a form of free government? One answer is that, unfortunately, there are people and parties in many nations who are so greedy for power that they will sacrifice the freedom of their fellow countrymen to obtain power for themselves. History, even recent history, is replete with such instances. That is why the citizens of the Republic of the United States and the Dominion of Canada must be careful to recognize at its very beginning any movement to steal or limit their freedom. That is not always easy. The man who would enslave a free people doesn't begin by saying, "Now I'm going to be your dictator." Instead, he probably will claim that he is a devoted supporter of personal freedom. But all the while, he will support policies that weaken and undermine personal freedom. Such a man will deny any totalitarian aims. But free citizens must not be deceived by such denials. Apparently, it is a cardinal principle of every sincere totalitarian that he is justified in lying, if such lies will advance his plans. In these times, no public figure and no party or organization supporting such a person can be accepted without careful consideration. Every public figure and organization must be carefully scrutinized. And if their real aims are to limit or to destroy our freedom as individuals, they must be opposed and defeated. Now the hermit again.
The next morning, Dr. Russell talks to Lyman about the mysterious Shirley. Is the doctor talking to a murderer, eh? Listen.
Lyman, I want to hear the story. In this clear, clean daylight, I want you to tell me your story.
It's nothing I can tell you.
I'm your friend, Hazel's friend. I can't see your lives ruined, see your whole future shattered. Some strange thing that holds you that, if it were brought out into daylight, would vanish?
You think it would?
I'm sure it would.
It's with me as much in the day as it is at night.
I found out since last night that Shirley Gray was a character in your last novel. Now, certainly, Lyman, you aren't going to sit there and tell me that you believe a character out of a storybook can return to haunt you.
Yes, yes, she does.
It's absurd. Besides, from what I know of ghosts, doors wouldn't bother them. They'd walk right through them.
Not Shirley. She isn't strong enough yet. She hasn't been dead long enough.
Then how should she kill Hazel? How do you know she wants to kill her?
For revenge. I killed Shirley when she was still young, lovely. She didn't want to die.
But how do you know she wants to kill Hazel?
Because night after night, she's come to me. Guided my hand while I write. Is written, I'll take your wife from you, just as you snatched my lover.
Lyman, listen to me. Characters from storybooks, I don't care how real they are to you, were never flesh and blood. They can't inhabit a spirit world.
But Shirley Gray was flesh and blood. I took her out of life and put her in a book.
You mean you used some real girl as a type for your story?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about it, Lyman. Perhaps I'll be able to aid you.
It was several months before I was married. You remember I went up to that lake in the north to write?
I remember.
It was while I was there that I met Shirley Gray. She was the most strikingly beautiful girl that I'd ever seen.
Max, this is Mr. Clinton. Mr. Lyman Clinton.
How do you do, Mr. Clinton? Shirley tells me you're an author. She's frightfully keen on your stories. But I'm ashamed to say I don't believe I've ever read any of your work.
No, don't apologize, please. I'm the one who should do that. Afraid I write for money, not fame.
Oh, it isn't true. We've had a grand time talking books. From early French beginnings of the novel to modern. From Zola to John de Pepper.
Oh, it's nice of you to entertain Shirley, Mr. Clinton. I can only come out weekends. Gets pretty lonely here at the lake with only your folks for company.
The pleasure's been mine, I assure you.
Come on. We're wasting a glorious day meant for swimming. I'll race you to the second sandbar, Shirley.
Right. Want to bet? What do they say?
Whatever you say. And so I spent days at the lake with her, walking through the woods, talking, and falling in love with her.
But this Max, who was he?
The boy she loved, was engaged to.
Yes? Go on, Lyman.
In Shirley's company, I could feel myself groping for new thoughts, beginning to live more than I ever had before. She had a free and full imagination.
Yes?
She wasn't muddled by life as most people are. She possessed a spiritual insight, clear, alive.
I understand.
And one night, I told her how I felt about her.
But Hazel, you were engaged to Hazel at the time.
I'd forgotten about Hazel. She belonged in another world. She had no existence in this one.
And so you told this Shirley?
Yes. We'd climbed one of the high sand dunes that afternoon, had returned. It was dusk. Shadows had begun to settle on the water. Stars were beginning to fill the sky. And we'd pause to watch their reflection in the lake.
You will be returning home soon, Lyman. And so will I.
I shall never leave this spot, nor you.
Not in mind, perhaps, but in actuality. This lake, the beauty of it all, will be something to remember on cold winter nights.
It's no use to disguise things from you, Shirley. You know I'm in love with you.
I know that, Lyman.
I'll never let you leave me. Never.
I think you will. You understand me. And yet you don't.
Meaning?
That you've read many things into me that don't exist at all. And have omitted one thing. The main thing.
Which is?
That I love Max. Love him very much.
No place for me?
Don't beg. I hate it. With Max, life is easy, unconfused. We're happy on a simple plane. We'll romp through life together and fight together. But not with too much effort.
The easy way?
Perhaps. But why take the difficult? I like life. It's fun. It may be drab and hard someday. But not now.
I haven't misunderstood you, Shirley. Quite the contrary. And I love you.
Please, Lyman, let's not talk anymore. Look at the water. See the boat way off in the distance, covered with a thousand lights, going somewhere. Let's just sit here and watch.
Help!
That night was the last time I saw Shirley Gray alive.
Yes, what happened to her?
She left the lake the next day. 2 days after, I returned home.
And asked Hazel to hasten your marriage?
Yes, because I wanted to forget this girl as soon as I could.
I understand.
But I couldn't forget her. I couldn't. She was with me constantly. So I began to write a story about her. That drove me wild.
Yet you finished the book? Published it, in fact.
Yes, I finished it. But do you know what I did?
I think I know.
I couldn't bear to think of Shirley living without me. So I killed her in the story. Then the very day that I killed her in the book, she was killed in life.
What?
Yes, killed. In an automobile. Instantly.
That had nothing to do with your story. You weren't to blame.
I was. I thought so hard, wanted it so much. I brought it about. I killed her. She wasn't ready to die. She won't accept death. Now she comes back to haunt me for retribution. Tell me, Doctor, what am I going to do? Help me if you can. Help me, please.
I will, Lyman. Tonight we shall go to the library together. And I will help you. I have a plan.
I killed her.
How do you do, young man? You're Max Pierce, aren't you?
Yes, sir, I am.
I'm Dr. Russell.
Oh, yes, Dr. Russell. I'm glad to meet you. But there's nothing you can do for me. I was in an automobile accident. Smashed up. Always have to walk with crutches.
I know what I'm going to ask of you will seem very strange and personal. But I have a very good reason. Will you hear me?
Oh, yes. What is it?
You were engaged to Shirley Gray, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
And loved her?
We were to have been married. I don't understand you.
You will in a moment. And Shirley Gray died?
Yes. And I had to live on. I don't want to.
If you're able, your doctor told me I might take you with me tonight to help save another man's sanity. We have to drive in the country. I'll tell you the story on the way.
This is all strange to me.
Now, don't be afraid. It's all right. Will you come?
Yes, I'll come.
To my car, then. I'll tell you the story as we drive to our destination. That's all there is to tell right now.
It doesn't seem possible.
I'm sane and considered to be a level-headed man. I've never believed in ghosts. Never.
Nor I.
But I'm compelled to believe this time.
But why doesn't she come to me?
Perhaps she will. Tonight. Here we are. It's 11:30. We'll find him in the library waiting. It's I.
Yes? Come in.
Who's this? Who have you brought with you?
Max Pierce. Do you remember him?
Why have you brought him here?
Oh, please, Mr. Clinton. I want to help you. And I want to see Shirley.
Perhaps he can talk to her.
You've made a mess of things. Seeing Max will craze her. She'll kill all of us.
No, I think it will give her peace.
She wants revenge, not peace.
But you need help. You can't go on this way.
Sit down, both of you. Be quiet and listen. Listen. Do you hear that rustling sound? It's the wind and the water. She brings the sound with her. Listen. She's coming. Nearer. Nearer. I can see her tonight. Do you see her?
Why? Yes. Yes, I do see her.
Shirley, my darling. Shirley, speak to me.
Max. Max, you've come to me.
Oh, yes, Shirley. I'm here. My darling, I love you.
Do you want to come with me now? Forever?
I do, yes. Surely I do.
But your revenge upon me.
I shall have my revenge. You shall go on living, suffering for killing others.
Shirley.
Don't be afraid to die. Death will be lovely when we are together.
What have I done?
I forgive you, Lyman Clinton. I leave you in peace. Come to me, Max. Follow me.
Yes, Shirley. I'll follow you. I'll follow you. I'll follow you.
Could Lyman's story actually have caused the death of Shirley Gray? A spirit returned and took Max Pierce to her, leaving Lyman to ponder and suffer the rest of his life. Turn on your light. Turn them on. I'll be back. Pleasant dreams.
All characters, places, and occurrences mentioned in the Hermit's Cave are fictitious, and similarity to persons, places, or occurrences is purely accidental.
The Hermit's Cave on Tuned to Yesterday, an NBC syndicated broadcast from 1944. You're listening to an hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now two strange stories on the Sleep No More series, penned by an author best known for his television work of the 1960s, writing episodes of The Thin Man, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Even Gilligan's Island, and Bonanza. Michael Fessier's stories, Over the Hill and The Man in the Black Hat, are featured next on Sleep No More and read by Nelson Olmsted from December 5th, 1956 on NBC.
In just a moment, Sleep No More. But first...
Summertime. Sounds like Charlie Spivak. Oh, yes, NBC Bandstand. Burt Park, Vaughn Monroe, Freddie Martin this week. Sure helps the morning along. That finishes the dishes. Now, let's see. Better get some shopping done. I can listen to NBC Bandstand in the car.
Anywhere, everywhere, it's NBC Bandstand. And now stay tuned for Sleep No More on NBC.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep No More. Turn down the lights, sink back in your chair, and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Once again, Ben, we have two stories for the price of one, and this time both are by the same fine writer, Michael Fessier. The first one is Over the Hill, and is about a man who lives in his imagination for three glorious days. I guess it was imagining things that brought it about. I mean, imagining some things and not imagining others, not even daring to think about them. Oh, I'd always liked to imagine about going over the hill and finding everything changed, but I never let myself imagine the other thing at all. Just the same, I must have been thinking about it, or it wouldn't have happened. I suppose I must have been thinking about it and didn't know I was. Oni, my wife, had been getting on my nerves, and it got so that even when I was away from her, she bothered me. When I was home, she nagged me, and when I was away, I thought about her nagging, and it was just as bad thinking about it as it was hearing it, and she cried, too, and that's what I hated most, her crying. She would cry, and I would try to get away from the sound, but I couldn't. I would go outside, and if I couldn't hear her crying, I would think about it, and it was as bad as hearing it, nagging and crying. Oh, it's a wonder I didn't go crazy. The only times I had peace was when I'd think things to myself. It was hard not to think of Oni and her nagging and her crying, but sometimes I managed it, and then I was happy in my way. I liked best to think about that hill. It was about halfway between San Ramon, where I lived, and the city. It would be nice, I would think, if sometime I would drive over the hill, and on the other side, everything would be different. The service station and the nursery and the dairy farm would be gone, and something different would be there. There wouldn't be any job to go to, and there wouldn't be any home to come back to. I was thinking this on that day, and when I drove over the hill, I found everything was different on the other side. The service station and the nursery and the dairy farm were gone, and it seemed like a park. The sun was shining, and there were a lot of colored flowers in the grass, and the water in the creek was blue. And there are probably a lot of children, I thought. And then I said, "My Lord, this is the other side of the hill, and it is different." And then it seemed quite natural, and I wasn't amazed or frightened. I just took it for granted. I don't remember getting out of the car, but I realized that I was walking through the grass and smelling the flowers, and the flowers were beautiful, and their odor was sweet. But what I liked best was the smell of the grass and the earth. The earth smelled as if there had just been a rain. I wasn't surprised at all when I saw the children. It was as if the flowers had come to life. They wore bright clothes, and they moved about as if the wind were playing with them. And they called out to me and smiled at me, and I felt that they knew me and weren't a bit surprised to see me walking among them. I walked as if I knew where I was going and what I would find. I took a path that branched off from the one I was following, and I came to a house that was white and had flowers growing around the base. The stream flowed through the yard, and the water was blue, except where the sun shone on it and made it gold. A woman came out and smiled at me, and I smiled at her and said hello. She was beautiful, and I knew how her voice would sound even before she spoke. It was soft and kind and happy. And she sat on a white bench that had vines around the legs and back, and she motioned for me to sit down beside her. I sat down and took off my hat and threw it on the grass, and I felt the breeze blowing through my hair, and I said, "I've been a long way off, and I've come a long way back." I didn't know why I said it, but she understood, and she nodded and smiled. And I said, "You're beautiful and kind." And she said, "Everything is beautiful. You're beautiful." And I thought a while. I guess I am, in a way. But I didn't know it.
You forgot.
Yes. I forgot.
It has been a long time.
Yes. It has been a long time.
But it isn't anymore.
No. It isn't.
There were two children playing in the grass, and I called to them, and they came over to me, and they smiled and sat down beside me, and I thought, I'm remembering again. I'm remembering something I didn't know. If I were to ask them who they were, they would tell me. But I don't have to ask them, because I remember.
The woman went into the house, and we followed her. She sat at a piano, and she played tunes that I had never heard, but that I knew. It was music that rippled and flowed, and then laughed and bubbled. I watched her hands as they moved over the black and white glistening keys, and I thought, it wouldn't matter if there was no piano and no music. Just watching her hands would be enough. It was night, and then it was day again, and I woke up feeling that it didn't matter that the night had gone, because the day would be wonderful too, and then night would come again, and
night came again and day came again, and the woman and the children and I were together. We walked and we talked and we rested, and the walking was fun and the resting was fun and the talking was fun. But I don't know what we talked about or even what I thought. I don't believe I thought. The woman was beautiful and kind and happy, and the children were happy, and I was happy. But I didn't think, she's beautiful and kind and happy, and the children are happy, and I'm happy. Because that was what should have been. It always was what should have been and always should be. Over the hill and on the other side, things were as they should have been. Things were as they always should be. It's hard for me to describe the change. I guess it wasn't a change at all. The thing was, and then it wasn't, and because it wasn't, it never had been. You can't change from something that never was to something that is. I had a dream last night, I thought, and I remembered it a while back, and now it's gone. I was over the hill and on the other side, and I was driving my car to work and thinking about my wife, Oni, and her nagging and crying, and I was thinking about how the crying was even worse than the nagging, and I thought it'd be nice to think about the dream, but I can't remember it. Then I was in the office, and I was wondering why the others looked startled when they saw me, and I wondered why some of them looked startled and frightened, and it was time for the conference to start, and I went to the boss's office. He looked startled, too, and he said, "Good Lord, what are you doing here?" "Why, I came in for the Monday conference." He said something to a secretary, and she left the office. "It isn't Monday. It's Wednesday. And even if it were Monday, what made you come to this office? So didn't you know they were looking for you?" 2 days, I thought. 2 days. This morning I got up and it was Monday. But while I was over the hill and on the other side, it became Wednesday. And then I remembered and I thought, it wasn't a dream. This is Wednesday. It isn't Monday at all. It's Wednesday. The boss's secretary came in, and with her was a policeman. And she pointed to me and then ran across the room, and she was frightened. The policeman grabbed me by the arm and hurled me against the wall, and he put his hand in his gun, and he said, "You better come quietly." "Well, why should I go with you at all?"
"Now, don't play innocent."
"Well, I'm not playing anything. I just don't know what you're talking about."
"I'm talking about your wife, and you know darn well I am."
"My wife? My wife? Why?"
"Because you killed her Monday, and you know that darn well, too."
This isn't Monday, I thought. It's Wednesday. It isn't Monday. It's Wednesday. And it seemed I should laugh at the policeman or become angry or shout to Niles, but I didn't. I felt I had to say something just to break up the silence in the room. I didn't kill my wife Monday.
"Well, maybe it was Sunday night then. My Lord, you're dumb. You didn't even change your clothes."
"Why should I change clothes?" The policeman pointed at the sleeve of my gray suit.
"Why shouldn't you have changed? That's why. What's that on your sleeve?"
I looked at it, and remembering and thinking ceased to be, and I said, "Oh, yes, I see. It's a bloodstain."
Nelson Olmsted again. That was the first one of our duet of strange stories by Michael Fessier. Number two is a haunting narrative about the very unusual Man in the Black Hat. I had no money in the black, and the stock market stopped on red, so after holding me upside down and shaking the last dime out of my pocket, they turned me loose. San Francisco isn't such a bad place to be broke in. You walk around and look at things and you forget your troubles. This day I was walking along Van Ness Avenue. Second-hand dealers had cars parked halfway across the sidewalk. Signs on the windshield said, "This car for $100, this car for only $25 down," and I laughed to myself thinking how I was broke and couldn't even buy gasoline for a motorcycle. Still, I read the signs and wondered which car I'd buy in case I had the money. And all of a sudden, I noticed a sign that didn't make sense. It said, "This car free. Inquire upstairs, room 402. Other people glanced at the sign and kept on going. They figured it was some kind of advertising gag. Well, so did I, but
I didn't have anything else to do, so I stuck around looking at the sign. It was on a brand new luxury 12 you couldn't touch for less than $4,000. Well, I'm curious, like all other gamblers, and I walked up a flight of stairs and knocked on the door of 402. Somebody told me to come in. I stepped inside, and a small man with a gray goatee raised his head. He wore a black hat of soft felt, like I used to wear when the horses ran right or the stock market chart didn't look like a cross-cut saw. And I said, "Are you the fellow that put the sign on the luxury 12 downstairs?" And he said, "Yes." "Well, what's the gag?" "No gag at all." He was looking at me out of eyes that didn't see me. They were solid gray, no iris or anything, just gray. Oh, they gave me the willies. I said, "Well, then, in that case, I'll take it, if you don't mind." "Not at all." And he handed me a pink slip already signed.
"Well, what else is there to this?"
"Nothing." "Thank you." I couldn't think of anything else to say. Don't mention it. Then I wasn't there anymore. I mean, I was standing in the room, but so far as he was concerned, I was a million miles away. He ignored me so completely, I felt I wasn't there myself. And I left. Well, the key was in the car, and I backed it over the curb and drove it to the luxury agency. And after a lot of haggling, they gave me $2,400 cash for the car. I took the money and played the stock market again. And this time I played the red, and I couldn't lose. The old man had changed my luck. The funny thing was, nothing seemed strange to me. Oh, I'd make words with my mouth and tell myself that the old man wasn't real and that the goofiest thing that ever happened was me getting a car for nothing like that. But the words didn't mean anything. Something inside me took the whole business for granted. I took my winnings and bought a trip for myself. I went down to Florida and cleaned up a few thousand shooting dice and betting in the races. And after that, I went to New York. One night, I turned a corner and almost bumped into the old man. I wasn't surprised, and I knew it. It seemed perfectly natural to see him, except that he was broke. I could see he was. And I said, "Hello, remember me?" His gray eyes turned toward me with about as much expression as marbles. "Certainly," he said. "How are you?"
"Well, it's Jake, it's Jamaica Ginger. You mind walking a ways with me?"
He fell into step with me, and I led him around the corner to where my car was parked. It was a $5,000 Imperial I'd bought a couple of days before, and I said, "This car is free." His eyes didn't show any feeling, but his lips smiled a little, and he said, "What's the gag?"
"No gag at all."
"Then, in that case, I'll take it if you don't mind."
"Not at all," I said.
And I took the pink slip out of my wallet and held it against the windshield while I signed my name, and I handed it to him, and he said, "Thanks."
"Don't mention it."
And he got in the car and drove away. Months later, I was in Monte Carlo. Oh, I did pretty good for a while. And then the little ball started ducking my numbers and colors, and I lost steadily for 3 weeks. And finally, I stood at the table and watched the croupier rake in my last franc note. I turned away, trying to grin, but it felt like a fuzzy worm was crawling around in my stomach. It's one thing to be broke in the States, but another to be broke in a foreign port. The worm tasted of quinine. Somebody tapped me on the shoulder. The old man, black hat, gray goatee, and expressionless eyes, was standing there. I didn't feel a bit surprised, not a bit. It seemed I'd been expecting him, and he said, "You dropped something?" He held out a roll of notes to me. "Well, careless of me to drop something I didn't know I had, wasn't it?" "Quite," he said. And I took the notes.
Thanks.
"Don't mention it. And if I were you, I'd play the black 13 and 9. All of a sudden, he was gone. I played the black 13 and 9, and I played them heavy and won heavy. I walked away from the table with enough money to last me a year, and I don't live in second-class hotels. I didn't think about the old man. I was afraid to. You look at the stars, and you don't think about them, and they're beautiful. You look at them and try and figure out how come they buzz around and never bump into each other, and pretty soon they get you locked up. That's the way I felt about the old man. If I took him for granted, he was just a quiet old fellow with a gray goatee, a black hat, and funny eyes. If I started figuring out how come, I'd go out of my mind.
I took my winnings and went to Paris and got bored. I wondered why I'd come. And then I knew. It was in what they call a Latin Quarter. A mob had gathered on the sidewalk. In the middle was a gendarme. He had the old man by the collar. His black hat was mashed and his goatee was mussed, but his eyes were expressionless. It seems the old man just walked up to a fellow in a high silk hat, pulled out a gun, and let him have it. They said the guy in the silk hat was a government official. Well, the next day I went to the American consul. He's an American, I said. You got to do something. He agreed to investigate. The next day he reported, well, I don't even know that he is an American. He says he hasn't any nationality. Even if he were an American, I couldn't do anything. He admits he killed a deputy. But why? I asked. The consul shrugged like a Frenchman. He says he didn't have a reason. That's all the police can get out of him, except that he didn't know the man he killed, hadn't seen him before, and hadn't even heard of him. Well, the thing didn't surprise me. The old man gave away an automobile to a stranger for no reason whatsoever. Why shouldn't he kill a stranger for the same reason? That added up. It made sense, but I couldn't get anybody to see it. They listened to my story and threatened to have me thrown in jail, too. I didn't know what to do. They wouldn't let me see the old man. They said he claimed he didn't know me and didn't want to see me anyway. I don't know if they were telling the truth. I suppose they were. I had to give up. I hung around Paris for 3 months and then caught a boat for home. I went down to the bar and ordered a whiskey sour as we left the dock. And just as I finished it, the old man in the black hat appeared again, and he said, have one on me. Now, if you put your finger in boiling water, you'll get scalded. But if you put it in molten metal that's 100 times hotter, you don't feel anything. Surprises that way. If I'd seen anything that was merely terrifying, I would have shrieked like a woman. But I saw the man in the black hat, and I was calm. Maybe I was too stunned to be frightened or alarmed. Anyway, I spoke calmly. You were being taken to jail the last time I saw you. I escaped. What will it be? Whiskey sour. How did you manage it? 2 whiskey sours. Why, I just walked away from there. I took my drink and I started to lift it to my lips. And then I set it down carefully so as it wouldn't spill. And I said, now look here. This can't go on forever, you know. One of us is out of our mind. And if it's a tie, I don't like it. Now, his head was turned half away from me, but his gray marble eyes swung around and stared into mine, and he shrugged and his eyebrows lifted. Is something the matter?
Good Lord! Something? Well, they executed you. They cut your head off with a guillotine.
So?
Yes, I read it in the papers.
That's their notion of it. Have another.
Give me the bottle.
I took a drink and kept my hand on the bottle. He took it from me and poured himself a drink, and he tossed it down without taking his eyes off me.
They did execute you. They cut your head off and you died. I know they did. Now, don't tell me they didn't.
All right. Have it your own way. I took another drink and I thought a while, and then I gripped the bar with both hands and I said, all right, I'm ready. I've got to know sooner or later, so let's have it. Who are you?
Don't you know?
I'm asking.
All right. I'll tell you.
A drunk came by and lost his balance, and he threw his arms around me and almost dragged me down. And when I got rid of him, the man in the black hat was gone. I couldn't find him anywhere in the boat. I'm in the United States now. I keep traveling around, but I know it isn't going to do me any good. Someday, someplace, I'm going to meet the man in the black hat again. And I know he'll tell me who he is. And I don't want to be told.
Can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it? Step over here, Nelson Armstead, and tell us about next week's story.
Well, next week, Ben, we have a story of breathtaking suspense by a past master of it. It's called 3 o'clock. Its author is William Irish. You'd better be there.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Kenneth McGregor. Mr. Armstead's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Armstead will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
Sleep No More, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 5th of December, 1956 on NBC. And that wraps up this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.